Yeah, so the next section really is the history of racism and anti-racism, and a few general remarks about immigrant communities in Britain. So the three most important, or the four most important waves of immigration after the Irish famine, Irish immigration at the beginning of the 20th century, I spoke about this last week or 2 weeks ago, Jewish immigration, West Indian, I'll do West Indian put onto you, West Indian immigration in the 1950s and the 1960s. These are the big times when there was no unemployment. Immigration from India, Pakistan and Bangladesh in the 60s and 70s. And today, immigration from Eastern Europe, Poland, Czech Republic, Romania, etc. Those are the important waves. Immigration comes in waves. This is normal. People don't leave their country because it's fun. Yeah? In fact, it usually isn't fun. People leave their country because usually because they need a job or sometimes because it's dangerous. So the situation today is 8% of the population in Britain say, I am part of a minority ethnic group. Yeah, so 8% identify themselves. Perhaps you remember that the situation is different in France and in Britain. In France, it is illegal to say, I am doing a study. Are you black or white? Are you black or white? This is illegal. You cannot publish statistics based on people's ethnic origins. Whereas in England, it is completely acceptable. Okay, it's a different culture. Yeah? The largest group then in Britain is the Indians. Alors j'ai oublié. Je vous ai déjà montré ça en début de oui c'est ça. Donc je passe rapidement aujourd'hui. Yeah, that's the picture which I showed you about this. Okay. Now, what is important about this is that the immigrants, and in particular the coloured immigrants, there are two sides to this. First of all, there has been a lot of mixing, and some aspects of Indian culture are generally appreciated in Britain today. We will look in a moment at Indian food and Bhangra music are generally appreciated. So there's that side of everybody liking things together. And of course, the other side is racism. And they both happen at the same time. So I'm going to look at some of the cultural influences and then at the racism. Now, many of you know a lot more about racism than me. But I know about the history of racism, so I'll stick to that. Of course, probably the biggest effect of immigration on the rest of England is Indian food, which is massively popular in Britain. This is your and the Indian takeaway is an essential part of most English people's lives, black, white, or Japanese, or anything. Yeah? Extremely popular. Now, this is a good example. In the 1960s and the 1970s, you would never see this. You would just see Indian food. And today you have ideas like Balti, which is a particular kind of Indian food. Now people know a little more. If you go on, if you go in the bookshops in London and you go to the cookery section, Indian food, make good Indian food at home. It's extremely popular and getting more specialised. This is quite a cheap one, but there are also quite expensive Indian restaurants these days. This is slightly upmarket. Finest Indian takeaway. And there are a million of these in London. Now, somebody asked me, is it real Indian food or is it adapted for the English? Well, the first thing is, I don't know, I've never been to India. However, India is a poor country, and probably in a large parts of India, the food is not so good, because it's more a problem of eating than gastronomy. One of my Indian friends says the curry is better in Bradford than in India. I don't know, but it's not impossible. Yeah, because when you have more money, you can get better ingredients and so on. Il y a eu un grand débat cette semaine parce que le Premier ministre anglais a dit il faut mettre en place un collège de cuisine indienne pour anglais. Parce qu'il y en a marre de trop d'immigrés. C'est un conservateur, le Premier ministre. Yeah, we have too many Indian immigrants for the thousands and thousands of Indian restaurants, and so we must establish... This is not my opinion, it's the Prime Minister's opinion, okay? So it's a very political question. Food is a very political question. So he's saying, you know, we need to teach everybody to make Indian food. Of course, the influence of reggae music has been massive in Britain and elsewhere. The biggest star, Bob Marley, is from the West Indies, but there are also a lot of British reggae bands. The most famous, no doubt, Steel Pulse. Ça c'est une coiffure. Yeah. Je crois que je suis trop vieux. Okay, Steel Pulse. Yeah, Steel Pulse again. So, of course, reggae music is a very, very important change. In the last 20 or 25 years, music from India has become part of a new musical phenomenon which mixes together traditional Indian music with modern rock, garage, dub, etc. And I have a couple of examples here. First of all, we have Janoon, extremely popular, not just among the Indian immigrant population. Okay, so singing in Indian languages, Janoon sometimes sing songs which are half in English and half in another language. It's quite a new phenomenon because in general, in England, you must sing in English. There is no market. It's not like in France. In France, you can sing in English or in French, and it will still be on the radio. In England, it's in English. That's it. And this is the first time, really, that there are quite a few very popular singers who do not sing in English, or quite often do bilingual songs, which are, of course, very interesting. Another group here Asian Dub Foundation, slightly different style. I'm just giving you one or two examples. Of course, there are dozens of examples. Yeah, so obviously here you have a mix. You have some traditional Indian, some rap, and some, I don't know what. It's a very, very sort of mixed up thing. You also have people like Apache Indian. Apache Indian, interesting, because he was born in Birmingham. His parents are Indian, and he sings in West Indian dialect. Okay, donc ses parents sont indiens, il est né en Birmingham et il chante en dialecte jamaïcain. Okay, so it's, this is what we call hybridity. You choose your identity. Yeah, you can have what you like. I like it. It's I don't have any here. I'm sorry, but you look it up on YouTube. Okay. This leads to quite an established now musical establishment in Britain. So in the 1970s, this music was only for the immigrant community. Yeah? But today, it really is generally available and very popular. And very popular. Here, so 2 years ago in September 9, this is the Soca Music Awards. Soca is Caribbean music, yeah? A particular style of Caribbean music. And so the Holiday Inn in London. Yeah, so a big hotel in the centre of London for the Soca Music Awards. This is music written and performed in Britain in the Jamaican style or in the Trinidad style. Okay, so you have a cultural presence in Britain of this, very public. And of course, the most famous example is the Notting Hill Carnival, the Londres Carnaval, which is so popular that you have posters in Paris saying, come to London for the Notting Hill Carnival. You have, you know, 500,000 people and more than 100 sound systems, okay, which can be still traditional Jamaican music or very modern stuff as well. There are West Indian festivals in other towns as well. And much more recently, now the Notting Hill Carnival is an interesting example because at the beginning it was very, very difficult to organise. The police tried to stop it every year in the 1970s. The beginning of the 1980s, big fights with the police. Well, and today it is completely, so it is supported by the government. They receive money by the government to organise it. So it has become official or officially accepted. Whereas for a long time it was a big cause of conflict. And in the last 20 years, there has been the development of the Mela. And a Mela is a festival of Indian and Pakistani music, dance, clothing, food, etc. And this is, 20 years, in the last 20 years, there are about 30 or 40 Melas around Britain. Very often they are organised by the local government. So it's much more official, much easier than was this at the beginning. C'est la seule photo que j'ai trouvée d'un Mela. Qu'est-ce qui s'amuse? C'est pas une très bonne photo, mais j'ai cherché Mela et c'est la seule photo que j'ai trouvée. OK. Some of the Desi is an Indian and Pakistani music. OK, so we've looked at the food and the music. Those are two important elements of immigrant culture and mainstream appreciation. I just want to look at a few famous people, British people from immigrant backgrounds. The director of this film, Gurinder Chadha, is one of the first Indian women in Britain to direct films. That was very difficult. For a long time, you always had women actresses, but not directors. And so, Gurinder Chadha. This is also by... Je crois que c'est Coup de Foudre à Bollywood en français. So, a rather specific approach... And this is from an Indian woman living in Britain, the director. We also have... one of the most popular novelists, serious novelists in Britain, Hanif Qureshi. I think he is Pakistani in origin. This is his... he must be Indian. This was his bestseller, The Buddha of Suburbia, which is the story about being an Indian immigrant in England. And last example, Ben Kingsley, who is an actor, a British actor of Indian origin. There he is playing Gandhi in the film Gandhi. Yeah. This is not Gandhi, this is Ben Kingsley. Okay. See. Okay, so again, just a few examples. I mean, it's just a few examples of some of the people who managed to make a space in here. Let's move on to something more depressing. Let's move on to the recent history of racism in Britain. First important thing to notice is that the level of popular racism, everyday racism, has definitely declined over the last 30 years, very much. When I was at school, at high school, I was 11, I was 12, racist comments was every day, which was bizarre. Because in my school, everybody was white. Yeah? But they still had racist jokes every day. It's a strange sort of mental illness. Okay, so very strong separation. When I was 15, I lived in a part of town where half of the population was white and half was Indian and Pakistani. It's cheap. That's what we moved there, because it was cheap. And the Indian boys played football over here and the white boys played football over here. I didn't see any hostility, but it was automatic separation. Now, this is obviously one extremely stupid. We could have learned something. But this was automatic separation. And this is not the case today. The situation has improved. I am not saying there are no racists in Britain, yeah, but the situation has definitely much improved. Partly because everybody works in a mixed environment. You go to work, you're a bus driver, you're a nurse, you're a teacher, and everybody's together. So very slowly, the white people learn something. Not very quickly, we're not very intelligent, but slowly, white people learn that, you know, mixing is good. So let's have a look at the political history of this then. Well, in the 1970s is the first episode. Well, I already spoke to you about the 1930s, but the 1970s, unemployment is rising, and at the same time, the National Front, the British fascist organisation, one of the British fascist organisations, which is very, very small, they begin to have some success. They use the same old story, the problem is the immigrants, etc., and you can see that little by little they are having some success. In one part of London, they get 40% of the votes. In a town in the north of England in 1976, 38%. Yeah? So the fascists with big votes. Now, this is isolated in five towns here and there. It's not a general national movement. But it is rather worrying. Two local councillors are elected for the National Front. And the response to it is the organisation by sections of the left of a new organisation, the Anti-Nazi League. The Anti-Nazi League is founded in 1976, and it is very active for 5 or 6 years. And the result is that the fascist organisation is divided and goes into a sharp decline. Je crois que vous êtes trop jeune pour vous rappeler, mais est-ce que vos parents vous ont parlé de SOS racisme au début, quand tout le monde avait le petit badge? Partout, des millions de petits badges. Touche pas à mon pote. That was the atmosphere. C'est une organisation très différente. Mais c'était, on les voyait partout, les badges. And look, you have they produced many, many different kinds of badges. Building workers against the Nazis. Single parents against the Nazis. Post office workers against the Nazis. Là, supporters du West Ham United, donc d'un club de football against the Nazis. There were many, many more. Les gens qui allaient au même pub, ils fabriquaient des badges. Les habituels de tel pub contre les nazis. A very, very popular music, supported by politicians, footballers, rock stars, etc. And this could be quite radical. In some factories, the workers went on strike. They refused to work with one of the factory workers who was a member, an activist in the National Front. The train drivers refused to drive the trains if there was racist graffiti. And we're not driving the trains until the racist graffiti is taken off. So a very big campaign against the National Front, which had two basic principles. The first one was leaflets and information everywhere. And the second one was, it must be impossible for the National Front to have any meetings. So for 10 years, when the National Front had a meeting with 50 people, there were 500 people outside trying to stop them. And the result was that they became quite demoralized. Because every time they organized a meeting of 50 people, there were 500 people trying to stop them. So it lasted four or five years, and the National Front declined. This is a history of the anti-Nazi League when we touched the sky. Okay? There's the anti-Nazi League. This is later. In the 1990s, 20 years later, there was another period of the anti-Nazi League. And of course, the other side of this, the anti-Nazi League, and also Rock Against Racism. And Rock Against Racism was established... Enfin, il faut pas que je dise le mauvais nom, là. Il y avait deux rockers très célèbres qui disaient des choses très racistes. Un, c'était David Bowie. Je suis désolé, hein, parce qu'il chante très bien. Et l'autre, c'était qui, l'autre? J'ai oublié. Et c'est en réaction qu'ils ont monté Rock Against Racism. And in every town, there were Rock Against Racism concerts, a big Rock Against Racism festival. Another one. Now, this is an interesting poster, because what you can see is it's a Rock Against Racism concert, but also you can see that it is not one produced with a lot of money, with very, very famous people. No. In every town, there were lots of small things. These are not very famous people. But sometimes they were big. This is the Anti-Nazi League and Rock Against Racism Carnival Against the Nazi with Steel Pulse. X-Ray Specs is an important punk rock band. Now, one of the amusing things about Rock Against Racism is that before Rock Against Racism, you had punk rock concerts, reggae concerts, and they were very separate. And in Rock Against Racism, for the first time, you got punk rock, which was white people, and reggae on the same stage, and you got a lot of musical influence as well. Okay, who else do we have here? Today, there are still organisations, important anti-racist organisations, and the most important ones today are probably Unite Against Fascism, and this organisation, LMHR, Love Music Hate Racism. And you can see here that they were able to organise a music festival 3 days long. So it's a big music festival, including different kinds of music, Punjabi beats, yeah, from Pakistan, and a whole series of other ones. And supported by one of the biggest trade unions. Okay, so this is the Anti-Nazi League and Love Music. Later on, Love Music Hate Racism were some of the important movements. The Anti-Nazi League in the 1970s and the 1990s. Love Music Hate Racism today. The National Front declined, and the British National Party, 20 years later, had some success. This is the British National Party.
Vous voyez qu'ils ne renouvellent pas leur argumentation, c'est l'Angleterre est remplie, il n'y a pas la place.
It's not true, yeah? Okay, this is their slogan. And the other slogan there, British jobs for British workers. So this is in periods when unemployment is high, there is this temptation to have some support for the fascist organisations. Notice this is a modern poster. Je ne sais pas si vous voyez, mais c'est le site web, donc c'est tout récent. And so this is in the last 10 years. In the last 10 years or so, the National Front is, I don't know where they are, I think they're dead, but the British National Party is active. Now, the situation is very different from in France. In Britain today, I think there are 10 local fascist councillors. Il y a 10 conseillers municipaux fascistes dans le pays entier. C'est sûr qu'on aimerait bien qu'on en soit là en France, qu'il y en a que 10 dans le pays entier. So they have not had the same success. Why have they not had the same success? That's a difficult question. So here is the campaign against the British National Party. And this is a campaign run by Unite, which is an extremely big trade union. What's interesting about this campaign is it does not tell you who to vote for. It does not say vote Labour or vote Liberal or vote Green. No. It just says, one, don't stay at home, and two, don't vote fascist. Yeah? Okay. So that's a very interesting example because, of course, in the trade union, it's not acceptable to all their members to have a campaign to vote Labour or vote Green. But it is acceptable to all their members to have a campaign, don't vote for the BNP. And so they've gone around the country with the use your vote, said ne restez pas à la maison, stop the fascist BNP, big campaign. This is 2 years ago. This is very recent. This is 2 years ago. And finally, we have a new organisation, 3 years old, the English Defence League, and they have joined the new fashion, and the new fashion is not to be against immigrants in general, but to be against Muslims. And so this is the new fashion, the English Defence League. Je fais de l'humour, mais c'est pas franchement rigolo. The English Defence League, they have been very active. They have had demonstrations in Manchester, in Leeds, in Sheffield. A demonstration is 200 people with 500 people against them. So it's not a mass organisation, but it is a worrying organisation. And there have been attacks on mosques and so on. So that's the present side of... Yeah, for example, yeah. They are... Alors, s'il y a des jeunes filles qui sont vraiment en manque d'amoureux... Non, c'est une mauvaise blague. ça donne pas trop envie. Okay, no more masks. Very frequently, when the English Defence League arrive in a town... There is a counter-demonstration. And this example, just last year, is it last year? 2000 and... I can't see the date. Yeah, last year, I think. In Manchester, anti-fascists run EDL out of town. Donc on les a virés de la ville. Yeah? This is the communist newspaper. And it says, far-right thugs outnumbered 3-1. Les antifascistes étaient trois fois plus nombreux que les English Defence League. Okay, so I don't want to exaggerate. This is not every week, but regularly there are things going on because the economic crisis is looking for that. And here we have an example of a monthly magazine. This is a monthly magazine, Searchlight, and they are trying to explain where the far right comes from and what you can do about it. It's an activist. It's an activist magazine. Finally, there are a series of campaigns in very specific areas, because one of the things which, probably in France as well, but one of the things which the fascists do is they try to organise in the football grounds with football supporters, and so this particular campaign has been developed against racism at football grounds. Quand il y a des joueurs noirs, il y a des chants racistes dans les stades. Yeah? And this is a campaign against this. Show racism the red card, la carte en rouge pour le racisme. And what's interesting about this is that they go to the football grounds on a Saturday and give information to all the people going there. So it's very, very interesting because it's very, very concrete, yeah? They don't organise meetings in the universities. They go to the football grounds and say, hey, let's talk about racism. Yeah, this is the truth. The fascists are telling lies, yeah? So very impressive, I think, campaign. So there's a lot going on. And finally today, I want to talk about the legal situation, the law. Yeah, because I've shown you about the organisations of racists and the organisations of anti-racists, but I want to look a little bit at the law. What does the government say?
Now, there has been a series of laws about racism in Britain, and I want to give you a little explanation of that. 65, 68, 76, 77. These are the different laws which have been passed. These are the different laws against racism in Britain. And some of them are rather unusual. So the first laws in the 1960s, for the first time, it is illegal to discriminate. Before 1965, you can say, oh, this is my shop and I only sell to white people. It's completely legal before 1965. 1965 is the first law which says that discrimination is illegal. In 76, there is the establishment of the Commission for Racial Equality, la Commission pour la l'égalité raciale, which tries to make sure that the law is followed. Then there is a long gap where nothing happens from the point of view of the law. Nothing happens. And 2000 is a very, very new idea. Because from 2000, you have a new law. And it takes a little bit of explaining. After 2000, public bodies, that is to say, universities, hospitals, local councils, everything which is the public sector, have a duty to eliminate racial discrimination. This is completely new. It's not enough simply not to discriminate. Avant 2000, il fallait simplement être sûr qu'on ne discriminait pas activement. But that's not enough. After 2000, they are obliged to eliminate racial discrimination. What does this mean? For example, if there is a hospital, big hospital, 1,000 people work in the hospital, and there are 50 managers at the top, and they are all white. This is probably not surprising. Under the new law, the hospital is obliged to do something about this. It's obliged to explain what the situation is and to act against the inequality. Donc il suffit pas de ne pas discriminer, il faut enlever ce qui est entré comme discrimination raciale. It's a sort of new idea. It's an intermediate idea. You know that in the United States, they sometimes have quotas where you say 10% of your employees must be from an ethnic minority. Now, quotas in Britain have not been accepted. There are no quotas in Britain. But there is this duty to eliminate. That is that the hospital must show that they are taking action to make sure that if you have 1,000 employees and 300 are black, which is not surprising in a hospital, then you must make an effort so that the correct proportion is at the top and not everybody at the bottom. So that is what's new. Now, it is difficult to know exactly how successful it has been. It's difficult to know. Yeah, I can explain the idea of what it's supposed to do. Une des choses qu'ils ont découvert, c'est que les gens qui font des comités de recrutement, les gens qui mènent les entretiens d'embauche, même quand ils ne sont pas racistes, ou ils ne savent pas qu'ils sont racistes, ils embauchent des gens qui leur ressemblent. parce que c'est un peu automatique. And so now they are obliged to show that they are making a special effort to get an equal situation. Final example, 2004. In 2004, new regulations came in about religion. And the law... Excusez-moi, c'est pas du tout 2004, c'est 2006. Je suis désolé. It is illegal to carry out religious discrimination, and all employers are obliged to make reasonable adaptations to people's religious needs. Let me give you an example. A supermarket with 100 workers. 5 of the workers are Jewish. And the Jewish workers say, we don't want to work on Saturday, please. The employer is obliged to say, okay, no problem. It's a religious need. You are allowed to do that. Because there are 100 workers, it is reasonable. If it is a small shop with 2 workers, they're not obliged. They can say it's not reasonable. In the same way, if you have a hospital with 1,000 workers and you have 100 Muslims, and they say, we need a room because we need to pray at prayer time, the hospital is obliged to have a prayer room. And all big workplaces must have a prayer room if it is asked for. Of course, if you have a small shop and there is no space, you're not obliged. Yeah? So this is a very interesting idea. All employers are obliged to make reasonable adaptations to religious needs. Now, of course, you understand that this is a big cultural difference, and in France this would be very, very difficult to push through. It's a very big cultural difference about religion, which is... Je pourrais faire 3 heures sur ça, mais je vais pas le faire. Okay. Vous êtes un peu excité aujourd'hui. Okay. C'est fini pour aujourd'hui, on n'a plus de temps. Mais je vous retrouve la semaine prochaine pour la suite.